Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing what the second Trump presidency means for Africa. I'm joined by very two special guests, Professor Francis Owusu and Professor Paul Reig Kamode. Professor Owusu is Professor of Community and Regional Planning at Iowa State University, and Professor Kamode is Professor in Geography at Trinity College, Dublin. Professor Kamode's research centers on the political economy of globalization in Africa, and Professor Owusu's research focuses on globalization and development policy, among other things. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you join me today. I look forward to a great conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Brilliant. So let me start off with Professor Kamode. So we've seen in recent times, Africa seems to be an important, seems to be a growing important, how am I going to put it? So everybody seems to be caught in Africa at the moment. Africa seems to occupy a particular position. Whether Africa realizes this or not, Africa seems to be like an important player to different people outside. And now we see Trump coming back, and we know how the first president went. How critical do you think Africa will be for Trump's second term?
So I suppose there's two parts maybe to that question, Michael. Mm-hmm. The first one is how critical Trump will see the continent as. And the second one is how important will the continent be to what he wants to do, irrespective of his kind of opinions, maybe of it. So I think, as you said there, Africa is becoming more geopolitically and in certain ways geoeconomically important as well, particularly in terms of critical strategic minerals necessary for the so-called green transition. So things like cobalt, for electric car batteries and things like that. There's been quite a lot of competition around, you know, those critical minerals. So on the other hand, though, Trump in his first term was very dismissive of the continent. He famously called African countries and Haiti S-hole countries. The African Union Commission demanded an apology on their website for that, and obviously people were very offended. But that was reflective of his kind of worldview. And so I think we'll probably see more of the same of that in his second administration. If you read the Heritage Foundation Project 2025 document, which a lot of Trump staffers were involved in drafting from his first administration, he initially said this was going to be the blueprint for what he was going to do. But then during the campaign, it became evident that this was a potential political liability. So he said it was ridiculous and abysmal. But since now he's putting his transition team together, he is appointing some of the authors of this Project 2025, it looks like, into his new administration. And if you read that, it's quite interesting about Africa. And there's a variety of ways. If he follows that line of kind of thinking and the plan that's set out there for Africa, there's a number of important things that will be done. So that Project 2025 talks about withdrawing from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, for example, that these are international institutions which work against American interests, and like many other international institutions, they should be either cut down to size or withdrawn from. He also, or at least the Project 2025 authors, talk about aid by itself being corrupting and promoting violent conflict. There doesn't seem to be kind of literature or sources or evidence presented for that. And it views the continent through the lens or prism of competition with China, which again was something which was prevalent in the first American Trump administration. So, you know, there'll be a variety of different impacts, and we can think about kind of economically, geopolitically, but I think those are some of the kind of lenses that will be brought to how the continent is viewed in a second Trump administration.
Okay, brilliant. Francis, let me come to you on some of the things Paul Reagan said. So I think if we look at where we are, like I was talking to Porrig before we started this, the conference we went, and one of the things one of the participants said was, like Riley mentioned, the Africa plays a very crucial role in terms of like the essential minerals, like in DRC, for instance, where you have about 70% of, you know, cobalt and some of these minerals. And you see that China has a hegemonic advantage when it comes to all of those kind of resources. So if we see in the last 70 years since the Second War, and I believe the IMF, the World Bank, all of these were, in my opinion, institutions that were created to kind of like control development in Africa, and also, you know, to be able to establish or entrench American hegemony. So to hear that America, Trump, he wants to withdraw, but it looks like it's a paradox. And seeing also the competition with China, how do you explain such paradox?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on this show. I want to start my comments by making one caveat, which is that one must be modest in predicting how U.S. policy under any administration would affect Africa. Because although Africa do not typically appear important in U.S. elections, policies are often the result of events in the global economy or events in Africa. So in other words, leaders come to power without a clear vision for Africa, but sometimes are driven by events to become more engaged with Africa. So for instance, George Bush, who was also very dismissive of Africa during his elections, after 9/11 changed his tone and became one of the strongest advocates for Africa, including his policy, the Millennium Challenge account that was established in 2002. And then later in 2003, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, FAFSA, that also became very, very important. In other words, George Bush became much more consequential than most analysts thought before he became president. What this tells us is that we have to be a bit modest because we don't know how, what will happen, and whatever happens, we don't know how Trump will respond to that. So that's an important caveat that I wanna put on the table. One of the things that you started talking about is how Africa has become very important. I think Africa has always been important, and I think we've seen we know that Africa became very important during the Cold War. And so during that time, there was, you know, the struggle to get allegiance of African leaders. And that was based mostly on politics. It was a much more political struggle for control and dominance in Africa between the US and the Soviet Union. Now what we see is, as Porek said, it's much more geoeconomic. There's political undertone, but mostly it's geoeconomic. How to have access to Africans' resources, and also to get control in Africa in terms of terrorism and other military installation, at least from the US's point of view. So we've seen this movie before, except that this time the focus is a little bit different, and the characters are also a little bit different. And so the question is, how would African leaders respond to this new dynamic that is taking place, and whether it's Trump or any African leaders? Now, to the specific question about you know, the paradox of US working relationship with China in Africa, I think that's an interesting point, because, you know, in many ways, US and international organizations opened the way to Africa to allow China to come into Africa, because the push for neoliberal economic policy, opening up of African economies, is one of the forces that encourage China to come into Africa. So what we are seeing right now with Donald Trump is actually a different form of globalization. In other words, the original form of globalization that allowed China and others to engage with the rest of the world, the US is beginning to see that that is not benefiting it. And so they want to rewrite the rules of the game by pushing more for economic nationalism. And that is underlying tone that you see in President Trump's economic agenda. The American first, these are all driven by, you know, a fear, a sense that globalization has not worked for them, and that we need a different form of globalization. And I don't think that Trump is necessarily against globalization, but he wants a different form of globalization, a form of globalization that allows the US to be able to go out to engage the world, but that does not, that curtails China's right to do the same thing, either in the US or in Africa. And we can talk about issues of immigration and other parts of things that are part of globalization that the US doesn't like, and so we want to change the rules of this new form of globalization.
Yeah, brilliant. Parag, let me come to you to respond to some of the things, or to just to some of the things you mentioned. So Francis mentioned that thought, some like there's a, you know, the Cold War, during the Cold War, Africa was very important to, you know, the former Soviet Union, and, you know, the non-alignment or alignment. But we've also seen right now there seems to be a thought scramble for Africa. And in that thought, scramble, Francis mentioned a different, America was a different form of globalization. What I, in my recent work, I'm talking about a new world order. So there's a quest for a new world order. You see different blocks expanding, and different blocks jostling. You see the BRICS is expanding. You see NATO is expanding. Everyone is expanding for this new world order. And then again, you see, particularly in Africa, there is a growing, let's say in the Sahel, for instance, there's a growing anti-French or anti-Western sentiment or narrative, and there's the retreat, see some kind of retreat of Westerners. So in this new world order, where you also have middle powers like Turkey, like United Arab Emirates, how does this all play out to Trump's calculation?
Yeah. So I think Francis is right when he talks about the way in which Trump it wants to reconfigure globalization. And I think, you know, what the Americans have been trying to do under Biden, but also under Trump previously, and it'll probably be continued in the next administration, is to institute a more activist industrial policy, because they've seen that China has pursued a kind of mercantilist policy where you try and restrict trade and investment, or put conditions on it to benefit your own economy and to disadvantage other places. So I think that's the kind of reconfiguration that's being looked for, that The Americans have seen a lot of their industrial base hollowed out. They want to reconstruct that because some of them at least see it as a source of kind of national power. And this occasions a kind of rethink of whether and to what extent and in what ways and in what ways has it not benefited from previous models of globalization. So I think, you know, Trump talks about imposing a 10 to 20% tariff on all exports coming from the rest of the world, up to maybe 60 to, I've seen 200% tariff on Chinese imports. Again, to try and leverage the advantage the US has as the world's biggest market before that dissipates, and also to try and shore up the role of the dollar as the world's primary reserve currency. So, I mean, you raise an interesting question there about whether we'll have a new world order based on some kind of balance of power between the emerging blocs, maybe centered on China and Russia and other allies, or will we have a world disorder where these competing countries and blocs aren't able to come to a kind of way of living together, which is cooperative at some levels around some issues and competitive in other ways? Or will it deteriorate into kind of armed conflict? And obviously, we've seen that happening in Ukraine. Taiwan is a potential flashpoint, as is now the Korean Peninsula. So there are various potential flashpoints on how the relationship between the US and China is navigated or negotiated will be really key to determining whether we are moving towards kind of more war and conflict and disorder, or whether we're moving towards a kind of modus vivendi where they're able to live together. Now, of course, you mentioned about kind of anti-Western sentiment in the Sahel. And, you know, there have been some very significant developments there. Obviously, there have been a string of military coups in the last couple of years and the creation of the Alliance of Sahel States in 2023, which is a sovereigntist claim, basically saying we've had enough of the French neocolonialism in the Sahel. We don't want American influence or imperialism, as it might be called, in the Sahel. We want to determine our own futures and agendas. And that aligns well with Russia's kind of sovereigntist agenda, you know, that Russia will provide military support in exchange for minerals, for example. The infamous Wagner group has been incorporated into the Russian army under the Africa Corps now. And so you see this competition, which has a kind of territorial dimension to it, in addition to having a network dimension. So as US companies compete to build broadband infrastructure or, you know, other kinds of financial networks, there's also this emerging kind of territorial dimension where, as Francis was talking about in the first Cold War, countries tended to side with either the Western powers or the Eastern bloc. And we could be seeing a kind of reemergence of that again. Apparently, there's now the same number of democracies and autocracies in the world, almost exactly as there was in 1990 at the end of the first Cold War. So we're seeing some of these dynamics reemerge, but also with differences, because China is a very different economy from the Soviet Union, and it's very deeply interconnected with the US, but also Western European, Japanese, and other economies.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned, you know, we've always looked at China, and in some of the conferences or private meetings that I've gone to in here in the UK, there's always that fear about Chinese influence, look at Chinese military bases. And I remember the last one we went in Chatham, as we're looking at, you know, Chinese have like limited military bases and all of that. But again, in the Sahel, if we look at the Sahel, not only just the Sahel, even in Central African Republic, in Libya, in Mauritius, you see Russia, the Wagner group that you mentioned, having some kind of like influence, military influence. And if we tie that into the Russian-Ukraine war, and what Trump has said about and Trump's relations, you know, with Vladimir Putin. Do you think it's able to solve the issue? How do you see Trump's relation with, I'm asking Francis now, with Russia, with Vladimir Putin? Do you think he's able to have any, I don't know if this is just Trump talking the way Trump talks, but do you think he's able to have any influence on Putin in that regard?
Well, I think that based on Trump's first term as a president and the second term, we can make some kind of predictions in terms of what is going to happen. But we also have to understand that although Trump has not changed in terms of his views significantly 4 years ago, I would argue that Trump has become much more ideological than he was in 2016. But other things have also changed. In 2016, Trump win was seen by many, was questioned by many, many in the US. But this time around, people have accepted that there's a clear evidence that Trump has, the Republicans have mandate. And Trump is coming to power with Republicans controlling both chambers. And Trump would have a close to maybe a majority popular vote. And that gives him a little more leverage to become, to be able to implement his policies. Other thing that I think is very different for Trump in the second time is that he will be probably much more effective. His government will be much more effective in terms of implementing its policies, including foreign policies. And we can look at the speed at which he's putting together the cabinet and the ideological nature of the cabinet that he's putting together. And the fact that, you know, in the first round, there were, Congress was there to be able to stop some of his impulses. And so Trump is coming to power this time in a very much more, in a stronger, much more ideological, much more efficient way to implement its policies. Now, how does that translate in terms of how Trump would deal with Africa, and Trump will deal with Russia, and Trump will deal with China and other kinds of things? I mean, in terms of its role, Trump's connection or whether he can influence Putin, Putin is a very astute politician. And I think that he will be able to get what he wants. He'll be able to push his agenda. As we see in the case of Ukraine, he's very astute, and he can use any other means to accomplish that. Trump is a much more, negotiator, to find ways to negotiate. And a way of negotiating always means that, you know, Trump may have to give some grounds in order to accomplish his objectives. How that will play out in terms of Ukraine, or how that will play out in terms of Africa, becomes a very different thing. But when it comes to the competition with China in Africa, that's also very different. The trade war that is going to be started, potentially started between China and the US, would have significant impact on Africa. And you know, the trade war, essentially, if we take Trump by his word, is going to be on manufactured commodities. And Africans don't export a lot of manufactured commodities. They export primary commodities to Africa, to the US. So we see how these things work. Another way that this can potentially affect Africa is the AGOA, the US policy that allows manufactured and other products from Africa to get into the US under favorable tax conditions. So those are the kind of things that you see in the way that the relationship with Russia and potentially with China can play out in Africa.
Yeah. Padraig, you mentioned in your last comment, you mentioned that we now have as many democracies as autocracies as we had in this. So if we look at Trump's disposition, or even if we look at the mature democracies like the UK, like even in the US, I would argue that democracy is on the retreat, even in mature democracies. And you see the growing militarization in Africa, with the growing military in the alliance of Sahel states now. You're seeing then in Sudan and other places. What do you think Trump's presidency is going to do? Is it going to encourage more autocracies? Because then again, I could link that up to maybe look at how maybe the West double standard in terms of Israel, Hamas, or even in Ukraine and that. Does that embolden autocrats in Africa?
Yeah, so great question. Again, as Francis kind of said, maybe it's hard to predict with any kind of precision what will happen. But certainly, obviously, Trump in some of his pronouncements has made anti-democratic statements about turning, you know, the military on the so-called enemy within the United States, his political opponents. So there's an important kind of signaling effect there. Also, Trump has shown that he likes, autocrats oftentimes. He talked about al-Sisi in Egypt as his favorite dictator, for example. He likes the kind of strongman, big man politics. He considers himself to be in that mold. And so he's able to relate to what he considers to be strong rulers. And again, that would suggest that there will be less support for, you know, democracy promotion and those kinds of things. And the lens of American foreign policy will be America first. That is, what will benefit the United States? In the same way as China deals, you know, with democracies and autocracies and famously has a policy of non-interference in the internal affairs of other countries, although whether that is the practice we could talk about. I think the US is moving more in that direction as well. So, you know, that Heritage Foundation report talks about full spectrum dominance in energy, that this will be a key point of leverage for the United States in its competition with China. Trump has talked about, you know, frack, 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 and drill, baby, drill. So where the oil comes from, you know, maybe won't be of that much concern as long as American corporations can get access to it, make profits off it, sell it to the rest of the world. So, yes, I think you're right that democracy is in trouble globally. We have seen some instances where there has been a rejuvenation of democratic processes and practices in some countries. But in general, autocracy seems to be on the rise. And that's an outcome of arguably the contradictions of neoliberalism, that as inequality, you know, globally and within countries has increased oftentimes. And as climate change impacts some countries, particularly in the global south, very heavily, there's going to be a tendency to want to see strong governments, or there's going to be a push to have governments that are going to be able to repress or control dissent and try and keep a lid on some of the social tensions and poverty that arise from, you know, the devastating impacts of climate change. And of course, Trump doesn't believe in climate change or restructuring. And so that is going to feed through into greater inequality, potentially greater conflict. It's going to increase pressure for international migration, both within Africa and, you know, across different world regions as well.
It's good that you kind of predicted my next question, but I agree with you on like the conference I was mentioning about the last time. One of the statements that one of the participants made, which was a bit quite shocking, is like the West needs to use its full ammo, its full whatever, in terms of like sticking or exacting its dominance when it comes to green energy and assets, and taking and clawing back some of the advantage that China has. And then again, you can see in DRC Congo, the West is like, okay, maybe we should less focus on those human rights conditions or those liberal peace conditions that kind of hamper us, so we can tone down on that. But you mentioned something that we've also seen in maybe in Chad, where it's more like a forced kind of democracy. You saw a bit of something like a coup, right? But they didn't receive that much criticism compared to the Alliance of Sahel States. And then they say there's the oil. Maybe the Americans are interested in the oil. And you talk about the frac drill. So if you look at it in climate change, Francis, Trump is a climate change denier. You know, in this space, I was seeing the recent COP29, and you know, I was watching the representative from India, from Nigeria, from all these other places, you know, the way they were looking at, you know, they criticizing the commitment of, you know, much more industrialized. How do you think Trump is going to, his second presidency is going to react to this climate change issue?
Okay. Before I talk about climate change, let me quickly talk about Trump's effect on politics that Porik talked about. I think that Trump has had a much more significant impact on politics in Africa, what I call the demonstration effect of Trump's politics. And that has, been shown, that has reflected itself in democratic retreat in Africa. That is, many governments in Africa, the push towards democracy has slowed down and is being reversed, and with the emergence of many coups that is coming. Another way that this is happening is also, which is a demonstration effect of Trump's politics, is the lack of trust, the emerging lack of trust in elections. And people are beginning to question elections the way that Trump has done in the US, or effectively did in the US. The point of disinformation and misinformation becoming very, very important in politics in Africa. So in terms of the impact on politics, it's becoming much more significant than we thought, even the first term. And it's taking some time for these impacts to be reflected, but nonetheless, they are coming. In the second term, we begin to see the importance of the culture war that was that has emerged in the US be reflected in Africa. And I think it's going to be reflected more through the way that the Trump administration will be able to control foreign aid to African countries. So all the issues of culture war, whether it's abortion rights and LGBTQ rights and all these things, are going to be much more significant in terms of how this plays out in Africa. And the other one that is also going to have an impact that did not necessarily start with Trump is immigration. And so, in other words, Trump, even before he becomes a president in the second term, some of all these things have become very significant in Africa, and it's having impact in Africa in terms of the demonstration effect. In terms of climate change and how Trump's position on climate change would affect Africa. We've already seen it in COP29. The amount of money that was committed, has been committed to supporting developing countries, it's significantly lower than what people asked for. And you know, if you look at the magnitude of the problem, this does not demonstrate any serious commitment on the part of the US or on the part of other Western countries. So we already beginning to see that. But much more importantly, Trump and the Republican, most Republicans' view on climate change is going to be very significant in terms of international cooperation and the role that the U.S. Government plays in that kind of cooperation. You know that there are different states in the U.S. and different cities in the U.S. that can continue to cooperate with African countries. But the U.S. Government, as an entity, the role that the U.S. government is going to play is going to be very significantly reduced because of the Trump's position. Now, how that plays in terms of access to resources in Africa, I don't think that the fact that the Chinese people have access to the resource, Africa's resources, much more successful in having access to China's Africa's resources, is because of climate change concerns in the US. I don't think that is the cause. So the Chinese people are going to continue to have access to Africa's resources, And I think if the US was much more interested in climate change, that could have been used to get the African countries to put maybe some kind of a break in terms of how the Chinese people get access to African resources. But that doesn't seem that's going to be happening. So what I would see is that the US maybe need to increase its investment and others in Africa, but African countries, I think, know that or have seen the US as an unreliable partner and have begun to hedge their bets by diversifying their sources, their investment to other countries. So that's going to continue until they see a significant commitment from the US and the Trump administration.
Yeah, you mentioned something. Let me ask Parikh to respond to that. Because in his first statement, you talked about the African agency. So in the first Cold War, the Africans were able to manipulate that competition between the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc. So following the last statement that Francis said about African agency being able to diversify, how are they able to leverage on this growing competition between the US, China, and then Russia? Do you see how they might be able to, and can we see an indication that that is already happening, or that is going to happen?
Yeah. So again, great question. I suppose it partly depends on the impacts of Trump's policies. I was watching another podcast the other day where Richard Wolff said, you know, the US, if it tries to isolate the rest of the world, it ends up isolating itself. And so I think Francis is right that the Chinese government maybe is perceived to be more stable, more continuous in terms of the policies and type of governance and so on. In terms of whether African governments are able to leverage this competition, so I suppose the Trump administration, it will be isolationist or more isolationist, unless there is another event like 9/11, which prompted George Bush to become more engaged in Africa and some other places as well. So that how that isolationism plays out could potentially reduce competition. The kind of friend enemy distinction, you're either with us or against us. Are you with China or are you with the US? And will African countries have to choose? Where, you know, they were, there was a more kind of multiplex, some people would say, order emerging, where countries could have relations but with both the Western powers and the Eastern powers and trade and get investment from both. Are we going to see a kind of fracturing into different blocks where countries will be asked effectively to align with one or the other? You know, that remains to be seen how that plays out. So African countries and political elites have been very skilled at kind of negotiating kind of external dependence for the benefit of oftentimes regime maintenance, but also for economic development, to get access to more aid and for other purposes, depending on the specific country and time period you're talking about and what the priorities of the particular government were at a particular time. Yeah. The other thing that we've seen is that when it becomes disadvantageous to become too dependent on one partner, then there is this impetus to diversify. And, you know, in Angola's case, we saw that the kind of overdependence or perceived overdependence on China was mitigated through a diversification strategy by the new government that came, or the new leadership that came into power in 2017 there. So again, we, you know, in the Western media, in some academic writings, African governing elites are oftentimes presented as they not having a lot of power. And I think that's inaccurate. Actually, they have a lot of power, particularly in relation to their own populations, but also because they are the gatekeepers for access to resources and markets and political support in fora like the United Nations. They actually have a very significant amount of power in how, oftentimes, in how they bargain or negotiate with external actors. And the rise of China, these other so-called emerging powers that you talked about, Turkey, you know, the United Arab Emirates, and others as well. India, of course, is Africa's, I think, second biggest individual trade partner now, ahead of, or it was a couple of years ago, ahead of the United States. So be obviously well behind China. But this reconfigures the dynamic and creates quite a fluid environment, depending on the kind of geographies of the countries you're talking about, what the immediate issues are, what kind of resources they have, and those kinds of things.
Brilliant. So I would come to the last question. I'll give each one of you about 5 minutes to give like a, starting with Professor Wusu, to give like a 5 minute prediction of what is going to happen in the next 4 years, and, you know, and what are the ramifications of, you know, whatever it's going to happen. If this happens, what's going to be ramification? If that happens, what's going to be ramification in terms of Trump and Africa?
Well, first of all, Trump, second time, the impact of Trump's second time on Africa, as I said, Trump itself has become much more ideological, but Africa has also changed. The world has also changed. But Trump's policy on what you call American first approach is likely to have a significant impact on Africa if he's able to move through the policies that are inherited, the ideas that are inherited in that. One area where this will manifest itself very clearly is the competition with China in terms of access to Africa's critical mineral resources and supply chains. And here, you know, the US is going to be a little bit more strategic in terms of which countries it aligns itself with, countries that have access to resources and countries that are seen as a threat to terrorism. The US would probably, the Trump administration would align itself in some of these countries with. Another way that this Trump administration can affect the U.S., Africa, is through the transactional approach to its policies, the way that Trump administration promises to be very transactional. And so it will be much more business focused in terms of dealing with African countries. This means that it will depend on which country that the U.S. is dealing with. The trade and investment, as I've talked about, Trump is particularly interested in bilateral agreements rather than multilateral agreement, and so multinational agreement. So multinational agreement like AGOA, Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which is due for renewal in 2025, may not be as easy as in the past. And Trump may want to deal with countries on one-on-one basis than dealing with Africa as a group. There are several other impacts that we can expect in terms of something that Parikh talked about, what the project 2025 would mean for African countries. These are all open questions that we can make predictions. But ultimately, what I would say is that the important question for me is how African leaders and civil society in Africa, when we talk about agency, African civil society also have agency, especially in the context of democracy. The most important thing is how the political leaders and the civil society will respond to this emerging global political political economy of economic nationalism, political uncertainty, and the formation of new alliances that Trump administration represents. And so this is something that we are going to be looking out for it. But African countries will have to embrace these challenges, and as they work with this the world's most powerful country, that is becoming more unreliable and very difficult to predict.
Good. Over to you, Parikh.
Thanks, Michael. So I think there's a few things that will be likely in terms of the kind of signaling around policy. First of all, it's likely that the global gag rule will be reinstated. So that will prohibit funding to organizations promoting reproductive rights that will potentially severely affect women who are dependent on those kinds of services, both directly delivered by the US and through the UN Population Fund, for example, maybe cutbacks, you know, in aid and donations to international organizations that deliver those kinds of programs. Secondly, I think there will be an attempt to distance from Africa. It won't, I don't think, be a foreign policy priority, but there could be blowback from that in the same way as Trump, you know, doesn't want to be involved in European security. And, you know, some of his advisors and some of his incoming administration have talked about, you know, European soldiers patrolling a potential border between Russia and Ukraine. Whether an arrangement like that will survive or whether European security will be thrown into turmoil and what the implications of that would be for Africa may be substantial as well, because the EU is Africa's still single biggest trading partner, if you consider it as a bloc. So there's a lot of uncertainty. The impacts on international institutions are unknown and unknowable at the moment, but it's likely that they will be further undermined. I think, you know, Trump talked about how Ukraine would never have happened or the Hamas attack on Israel would never have happened under his watch. I actually think his first administration sowed the seeds of many of those things through the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, for example. So he had this kind of sleight of hand, or he elided the ways in which his undermining of the international order actually laid the groundwork or foundations for some of these conflicts. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something which could be a danger for Africa as well, because I think there will be disinterest in getting involved in trying to negotiate a settlement in Sudan to the civil war there, for example. And again, conflicts can spill over, they can multiply. And because we live in a globalized context, you know, where Ukraine not being able to export as much wheat had massive food security implications for many African countries, for example. Unfortunately, I don't have a very positive picture to paint. There could be some potential upsides as well. So, you know, Trump may goose the American economy, kind of stimulate economic growth, take on more debt. That could have an impact on higher commodity prices or drive commodity prices and so on. Exactly how these things will play out, it's not clear. But I think generally we'll see a policy of kind of disengagement, except where it's perceived to be strategic in terms of competition with China or US national security or economic interests. And I think we'll see a kind of pinpoint or laser focus maybe on those areas or countries where it's perceived that either they're important in terms of the competition with China or for economic reasons or security reasons. But, you know, Trump has made his attitudes to security quite clear. For example, when he said if NATO, European NATO members, you know, didn't pay their fair share, as he put it, you know, he would encourage Russia to do whatever the hell it liked. So now some people have said that was a pressure tactic to try and get them to spend more on their militaries. And it's not that he's going to just let us descend into a world where might is right and, you know, military conquest is going to be the order of the day. Hopefully that's not going to be the case. But again, this is also tactical to keep perceived opponents off balance. But it'll be very transactional, as Francis said, but with an eye on American interests narrowly defined and defined over the short term, which will be to the fore, I think.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think with Trump, you can predict certain things, and some of the things are quite uncertain, but we'll leave it at that and hope for the best. But thank you very much, Professor Kamudi and Professor Wusu, for your very rich insights. And I really, really appreciate this conversation. I enjoyed it. Hopefully, you know, the right people will listen to this and the right things will be done. But thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you.
appreciate it. Have a great great evening, Professor Kamodi. And Professor Wusu, okay. I think this is still morning or afternoon where you are.
It's still morning here.
It's still morning. So have a good morning. Thank you very much. Keep in touch.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, everyone, for this tuning into this exciting episode with two giants in the field, Professor Paul Ray Kamodi and Professor Francis Owusu. Join me as usual to thank them for their time and for their very rich and useful insights on the implication of President Trump's second term for what implication has for Africa. I encourage you to subscribe and join me next time for another exciting episode. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you.